Hello, I'm Fern Cotton, and this is Happy Place, the show that sheds new light on difficult pasts. Today, I'm chatting to Lem Cisse.
I wanted to get my files from the government so that I could at least have some context with my own childhood. Am I mad or did it happen? Because it is the worst thing that anybody would want for their children, that is that they were left in a wilderness with no family member to acknowledge their existence from the time they were born, that they would be deprived of touch. It's emotional Hiroshima is what happened to me. And I was the only witness in that wilderness. And I knew it. And I wrote poems as witnesses.
Lem is a BAFTA-nominated, award-winning writer and broadcaster. He's also the most beautiful poet. And for the last decade, he's composed a short four-line poem as dawn breaks each morning, which he shares online. Recently, they've been collated into a book, Let the Light Pour In, which is so beautiful. These poems are so life-affirming. They're so witty and they're so full of wonder. But they're fueled by a hardened resilience that Lem's had to develop in dark times. He had an extraordinarily traumatic childhood, which I'll let him tell you about shortly, and which he details in his brilliant memoir, My Name Is Why. He grew up in care with no one to call family and is now infinitely passionate about telling stories and taking action that exposes and rights the injustices in the care system. He's also, by the way, one of the funniest people I've ever met. From the moment that he walked through my front door, he had me cackling. He's just the best.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Right, here we go. This is the show. Oh, Lem, I'm so happy that you're here. I am such a mega fan of your writing. I've got a million and one things to ask you today.
Fern, it's a pleasure to be here. I've listened to a few of the Happy Place podcasts. I'm going to listen to a lot more of them. I like what you do.
Oh, thanks, Lem. That's so kind of you. I want to start with Let the Light Pour In, this beautiful book of quatrains, your four-line poems that you write every single morning. They're so beautiful. I just pick it up whenever I can and just read whatever one I turn to. I've got favourites as well. Can I read one of my favourites?
Yeah, please.
The moon tells the sky tells the sea tells the tide tells me. Oh, it's gorgeous. And these come to you every morning. It might take minutes, it might take hours, but this is a daily practice for you. What does that daily practice bring you?
I think it centers me in a way that maybe meditation centers people, although it's not meditation. it's not that, but it prioritizes things in the morning. So it allows me to get a little bit in touch with nature, maybe a little in touch with how I'm feeling. Maybe I do it every day. I put out four lines, a four line poem. It rhymes on the second and the fourth line. And then I put it out on my socials, Instagram, not as much Instagram, actually Twitter, Facebook, etc. And I make them up in the morning and I put them out and they might be crap. You know what I mean?
You pick the best ones for the book.
The best ones are in the book, absolutely. Absolutely. But writers constantly face the possibility that they're just not that good.
Oh, it's the worst. And also, you get to a point where you think, I don't know if something's good or not. Like, I've just finished writing. I've written a bunch of nonfiction, but I've just finished writing my first fiction. And I have now read it 8 trillion times and I'm numb. I'm like, is it good? Is it shit? I have no idea.
I think writers like you, in that case, are right on the front line, facing the fact that you might not be that good.
I know, it's, you know, horrible.
Yeah, and that's why I think that we have, I think we are, writers are a lot stronger than people think,
yeah.
Firstly. And we are constantly facing the fact that we might be ridiculed, you know.
Oh,
and people don't think that, though. They think that, you know, like, they think that, I don't know what they think. They don't think writers are vulnerable. And actually, they are incredibly vulnerable. Artists really put themselves out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Just any creativity, you know, that it's, there's huge vulnerability that goes hand in hand with it. But your poems, they've brought me so much joy. And I love what you say in the introduction, that it can take seconds to read a poem, but a lifetime to understand one. When you revisit these particular poems, because I know they're not all quatrains, you've written some other beautiful poetry, but do they change meaning when you revisit them?
Yeah, they can, Fern, change meaning. Like when you look back at a photograph that of you when you were a child, and you'll have your family with you or whoever with you. As you grow older, you start to understand what really was happening in that photograph.
Mm.
Maybe very different to when you first, you know, first had it taken. And I think it's so true that as you grow, you look back at a photograph and you understand it more. You understand what your mum was going through, or your dad, or whomever. And the whole photograph changes. And you think, my God, I've lived with this photograph all my life and it's just making sense.
Mm, it's fascinating, isn't
it? Oh, yes. And same with poetry.
And you say that you found poetry, or you were led to poetry due to your upbringing, going to church, the rhetoric and the lyricism, that took you to poetry.
I don't know. I'm asked the question, why did you start writing poetry? Why are you a poet? And I think, well, the logic may be this. It may be that I was at church. It may be that my foster dad was an English teacher. It may be, but who really knows? How do you know that you were going to be a broadcaster that you are? You know, who really knows, you know? You know, we find our way somehow in the creative industry and we look for kind of logical building blocks that could say, oh, this is how we got to here, or what vehicle took you from A to B? What fuel did you use? And we're looking for exactness in what is not an exact industry. Creativity is really powerful, you know. It doesn't need an excuse, a direct excuse. But it just needs the impulse to do, okay? So we look for reasons for the impulse to do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you do this writing, Len, because you had a broken childhood, or because you had a blah, blah, blah. And actually, in my experience, creativity is around all the people all the time. And it's there for us when we have the impulse. So creativity is in everybody, everywhere.
Without a doubt. What a good point. Yeah, I think we try and search for these reasons and there might just not be any. We just have the impulse. But, and I find it really fascinating with you specifically, knowing what you know about your childhood now and looking back on your foster parents, but also knowing what you know about your birth family and your roots. How do you feel about nature versus nurture, and what has an impact on who you are today and what's informed who you are today?
I have a play on at the Hammersmith Lyric at the moment. It's an adaptation of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. But there is a line in it where they question, the central characters question whether nature nurtured this monster that's in the bedroom. That's what happens in Metamorphosis. Or whether nature nurtured the monster, or whether there was nurture of nature that made the monster. It's a wordplay on this. You've had children and you will know, and I think this is all connected. I haven't got children, but I think it's all connected that I think you will look at one child and you can see the making. I think you can look at the child and think, where did that come from? She's obviously that personality, you know, and you know, how does that make itself? What am I saying? What I'm saying is that I was that kid. I was the child who wakes up with his eyes wide open and who opens the curtains and thinks the world has been waiting for him to open them. So it's the world will then go, okay, come on, let's do this. Let's do this. I was that kid.
I love that.
I was that kid, and I thought the sun came up for me, and I was like, hi, sun. Yeah, let's go. Let's go meet the people at school.
Yes.
Let's go do this now.
You know? So you just turned up like that.
Yeah, I was that kid. And I genuinely thought that people, everybody smiled. Like, I was like, this is so cool. I can go into the corner shop and Mrs. Jolly. They were called Jolly in the corner, Mr. and Mrs.
Love
Jolly.
Them. I love them.
I was the kid they would give an extra sweet to, or, you know, people stopped and at school, that's just the way it was, man. I thought this was the way for everybody. You know, this is everybody's. I had more than anybody. It was really important to me, actually, because people were important. People were really important. People were very, very, very important. And to see them smile was very important to me. Somehow it lit something in me when I got the smile back. And I just thought the world was a place of smiles. I had a little school on a little hill with stuff, you know, running tracks and church on Sunday and what have you. Life was a blast.
Yeah.
Life was a blast.
That you write beautifully about your childhood, the good, the bad and the ugly in My Name Is Why, which I read in about two sittings. I couldn't put it down. So beautifully written.
Thanks,
at times, man. Utterly heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah.
And to cut to the chase, you only got quite a lot of this information very recently. 2015 was
Absolutely.
When you were privy to your birth certificate, your records,
yeah.
all of the documents from the social workers.
Yeah.
That was a 30-year fight for
to
attain this information.
Made Radio 4 documentaries about it.
Yeah.
There's a Radio 4 documentary in 1995 called Child of the State. Made a TV documentary about finding my father and tried to get my files for that. And I was in care for 18 years, and so I've got 18 years of files that tell the story of my childhood, which is normally the proviso of family. Family is the unreliable narrator. It says, you were this, I know you were this. You did that because of that. You went there. Do you remember when we went there and you did that? And you can have a little argument whether you or not you did that. And did you go there anyway? Were you there? You know, this negotiation of memory is what families consistently do, you know.
But you had lies coming from all angles, because you had the care system lying to you, but you also had, at points, your foster family lying to you, telling you that your birth mum didn't want you. So
yes.
You had a lot of false information coming your way.
I don't mind lies. I think family does a good turn in lies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think family will set out the parameters of its experience, and don't go outside those parameters. Stay within them. I'm talking about family in general,
yes.
You know, and it's like, you know, and a child may grow to then question those parameters, and that's very dangerous territory. They go through their teenage years, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea of the story of the family is kind of central to who we are, to the point that it becomes invisible to us. And I didn't have that. I left care at 18, and I didn't have the family to hold any memory, any brothers or sisters or aunts and uncles. I grew up with, after leaving care, I had people saying to me, yeah, but I know it's tough, but just, you know, get your head down, and that all works. But every time I had any success in any way, it became apparent to me that I had no one. I had no family, no mother, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, great-granddads, not one single one to hold a memory of me in mind. That affects me to this day. So I wanted to get my files from the government so that I could at least have some context with my own childhood. Am I mad, or did it happen? Because it is the worst thing that anybody would want for their children, that is that they were left in a wilderness with no family member to acknowledge their existence. From the time they were born, that they would be deprived of touch. It's emotional Hiroshima is what happened to me. And I was the only witness in that wilderness. And I knew it. I knew it then, Fern. And I wrote poems as witnesses. I am telling this story now because this story affects my everyday life now. This isn't a narrative that's built in some way to... it's just that as you do interviews, and I've done many, you know, you talk your story, you know, you find yourself finding similar ways to explain it, and those similar ways of explaining solidify and they become unreal in their solidification. And actually, the story, like all stories, is it's a very fluid and moving one. Every time my birthday comes up, every time Christmas comes up, every time I have a relationship, every time a relationship breaks down, you know, the idea that you may, that wilderness is waiting for you is a very real concept. Your children, as they grow, they will look back to how you taught them and they'll go, oh no, my mum always said, okay, all right. Yeah. Or I disagreed with my mum then, but actually, you know, I'm 30 now and I actually agree. Or I disagreed with my mum then and I'm in therapy now because my disagreement actually. And yeah. You can look at your child. Anybody can look at their child and think, oh, you're going to be in therapy about
yes.
this. But I didn't do
every
anything,
damn
okay?
Day.
Yeah. And actually what happens at that point is that you just think, you know what? I've just got love to give and they're going to get my love and this is how it works. This is how my love works. And the child can get older and then they might be 60 years old themselves and they'll say, but I was loved. And they'll slowly understand everything that you did, you know. And they may struggle with it as well. Anything that any parent does. Well, mine is the wilderness. That's the place that I have. That's the gift I was given. And I'm aware of that. And I'm okay with that. But that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean...
And now for the joyous podcast, Happy Place.
No, this is important shit, Lem. It's so important because it's a feeling that, you know, I can sit and listen to you talk so beautifully today and I can sit and read your book and feel that pain and empathize. But I don't know what it feels like.
Yeah,
and it's really important to talk about it because your story is, again, so specific and there'll be some people that... might understand this feeling a lot better than I do, but I think it's so important to talk about.
Yeah.
The story starts with your Ethiopian mum giving birth to you, and then the government stole you. Let's talk
frankly.
Base language about this. They stole you and put
you
straight into a foster family. Just talk to us about how that happened and why that happened.
Mum came here to study. She found herself pregnant, and she was sent from Newbold College in Bracknell to, which is still there actually, to the north of England, into a mother and baby home. You might know the stories of the mother and baby homes. They were featured in Steve Coogan's Philomena. Actually, that's when they first broke, I think, across culture. And in those mother and baby homes were baby farms where children were adopted, often told as they grew older that their mother didn't want them. It's not true.
No.
I think that most mothers who have children, if they give the child away, to say that they didn't want them is a real travesty, actually. This is actually more about women than it is about the children that they had, actually. It's more about how a pregnant woman was seen as a threat to society, a kind of estrogen terrorist who might explode at any minute.
Yeah.
Estrogen in the world!
It's a good vision.
But they literally locked the women up. They were with the nuns and the social worker that ran the homes, and the social worker would ask them to sign the adoption papers while they were at their most vulnerable. You can tell I've said that before, can't you? But my mum came into that maelstrom of this very effective situation. And by the way, I believe in adoption and I believe in adopting parents, and we need adopting parents out there. And I think that a child will always find your weakest spot. Money, relationships... A child will find that spot in you or in the dad, you know. A child will like go, press it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And therefore to adopt, I've said this before, but I want to say a child, like if you have a problem with your mum, a child will say to you, I love grandma. Grandma is good. And if you have a problem with money as well, your child will say, grandma gives me money.
Yeah.
You don't give me what. Whatever your weak spot is, a child will find it. Whatever you think is the hidden bit of you that nobody else knows about your own development, a child will press that. And they don't know they're doing that.
No.
You know, and that's the blessing. So therefore, to adopt is the greatest thing that a human being can do. You know, and to have a child as well, I've got to say, you know, to be the parent and to share yourself. My story's didn't mean to be, but it's selfish. It's all me. But one of the things about having a child is that you realise it's not all about you. It's not all about your story. And that's a real brilliant lesson to learn. I think it's the same with faith and religions, etc. It's like, oh, there's something bigger going on, you know. But my mum came into the home and she wouldn't sign the adoption papers to the social worker when he visited. She would not sign them, and she wanted me to be fostered for a short period of time. And the social worker gave me to foster parents and said, treat this as an adoption. He's yours forever. And you have to know that everybody in this story thinks they're doing the right thing for the baby. Okay, it's really easy for us and me, you know, and it has been, to how dare they do that? This happened on our watch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This was our society, our 1960s
yeah.
society.
We're not talking 500 years ago here.
No, this
is recent.
Yeah. And, you know, we are responsible, you know, we were part of that society. Anyway, the social worker gave me to the foster parents, and they then, I was 2 months old, whatever. They then taught me to call them mum and dad and said they'd be with me forever and ever. And that was the deal. They were my mum and dad, and I was very happy. I was the boy that woke up with his eyes open thinking the world smiled.
Until you got to 12?
Until I got to 12 years of age, when they decided that they would put me into children's homes, into care, and then they would never visit me and never did. And that was it. And then I spent the next 5 years from 12 to 17 and a half in 4 different children's homes. The last one was like a prison for children. Because people will ask, what did I do? And I didn't do anything. But that was a really difficult narrative. It's interesting that we speak about trying to find threads. I was the only through thread of this story, right? Therefore, I'm somehow to blame. And the people around the children's home who lived in the town and the villages, they thought we were all bad children. So there must be something in it. I must be the bad kid. The foster parents talked about having the devil inside. They were very, very religious, which is why they took me. So that they took me and then the devil took me away. So this was the logic. And then I was in care for a while and then I left at 18, and at 18 I realised I didn't know anybody for longer than a year because I'd been in 4 different children's homes. Staff changed every 4 hours. Kids came in and out. And I was the only witness.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It seems like that feeling that you had done something wrong started before 12. This was a feeling that crept in even when you were living with your foster mum and dad, that you kept thinking, well, I've definitely done something wrong here. How did you go over that? Like that, if that's so ingrained in who you are as a kid, and then going from foster home to foster home, like you say, having done nothing wrong, but ending up essentially in a prison.
Yeah.
How do you not feel like that anymore?
So a bit of therapy.
Yeah, always helps.
I mean, the prisons are full of people who've been in care from 18 to 25. There's a very high amount of young people who've been in care. Well, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy when everybody in society uses terms like, if you're naughty, I'll put you in a children's home, to their own kids. You know, they don't mean anything bad by it. But the idea that children in care are intrinsically bad, believe in that before you believe that, oh, they need care.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it's a prejudice. But how do any of us get over, like, the pain that we've been through, which has been exacted upon us quite often because of a kind of prejudice?
Yeah.
Okay. So whether that's prejudice from the old to the young, men to women, from one to the other, racial prejudice, prejudice against kids in care, prejudice if you're disabled, whatever. I was under a sustained attack for 18 years. Okay. A sustained attack. I had my name changed. I mean, when I got my files, it became really evident. So, sorry, you're asking me the question, how did I get through? Therapy was very important to me, and not as important as turning off my phone.
This might be a very important phone call. You never know.
I don't care. I should know better. Sorry. I do a series of things. I stopped drinking when I was 8 years ago. That was very important to me.
Yeah.
I've been in therapy since I was 32. And I can kind of afford therapy, which is good. So the point is that just no success that I've ever had, I would always have this, the wilderness moment of, there is no family that I've got who can say, from that knew me as a child, that can say, well done, Lem. And I would often come back to that at various things. Therapy's really helped me. Therapy's really helped me. Yeah. I think that my story is, all of our stories are, allow for us to build bridges to each other. That's it. That's all it is. Anybody's story. Okay.
Yeah.
So my story is not worse than anybody's story. I know you could, there are a billion points of it. You know, searching for that narrative line, right? You can go, well, he doesn't have that, and I do have that, and he doesn't have that, and I do have that. But actually, we can empathize with each other's story. We can't know it.
Yeah. And we can connect through pain, which I think is always the biggest surprise. I always have assumed we connect through joy and love, but actually, a lot of time it's pain. It's a really lovely way to connect to other people.
We have to watch out for that, for connecting through pain. Sorry, not you. I do, because my story is so catastrophic that I don't bring it to the table. I see it as an opportunity to form bridges and have empathy for people. So, you know, I can see a mother might cry because a child's just cut the finger and it's the first time they've seen their own blood, the child's blood. I mean, it won't be the first time, but actually to see it disappear, running away from their child, the lifeblood, that's a shock. Now, oh my gosh, or to hear that something's wrong with your child, just to hear that, the need to try to solve it, it's life and death for the parent, I'm guessing. That experience is the same as any experience I've been through. And if the experience I've been through, which was horrific in my childhood, stops me from empathizing with that person who's just seen their child cut, or just cut themselves, or just ended a relationship themselves, or just suddenly, if I'm like, oh, well, my wound is bigger. Because I swear, for a lot of my adult life, in the back of my head, I mean, now I'm saying to myself, oh, God. Now I say to myself, oh, now they're dying. Now the families come together for their deaths. Because people I know are dying and their families are coming together for the deaths. When I was 20, I was like, oh, now they're marrying.
Mm.
And the family are coming together for the marriages. And then I had a friend say, I'm sick, I'm going, my mum's sick. I'm like, oh, now the mums and dads are dying. So they're going to go back to the place that they've always told me that they'd never go back to. Of course they are, Lem, you know that. What I'm trying to say is that that's not a good voice, you know, because And I've really had, that's been, actually, I think that's been my biggest struggle.
Yeah.
Is like not feeling that people are, oh, you have a family. And you, and now they're falling out with their mum and dad, and they're telling me, oh, my mum's a pain in the ass. And I'm like, yeah, that's what family is. There was no contract that said you wouldn't dislike your mother for a year,
yeah,
or whatever. Just, it wasn't in the deal. It wasn't, they didn't give that deal. The fact is, you've got something to be angry against, and I haven't. So that voice that I've just shared with you, which is real,
yeah,
is one that I've had to really work at most of all. So it's not just that what I've been through, that's a given. But what is my take on it? How have I, you know, and family's around you all the time. So navigating this world with my story is quite tricky sometimes. But it's tricky for all of us.
But I think it's very empowering to mention that you can change, maybe not change the voice, but you can have an awareness of that voice, because we've all got one, yeah, of those acerbic little narratives going around.
Yeah.
We might not be able to completely eradicate it, but we can take a step back, have awareness and go, oh, it's that voice, and this is probably not going to make me feel very good. And that doesn't negate the hard work that it is to have that awareness, because I think it takes amount of effort to just step back and go, oh, it's that voice.
Fern, let the light pour in.
Yeah, there's one poem. Let that light in.
One poem in here. I am the bull in the china shop with all my strength and will. As a storm smashed the teacups, I stood still.
Oh, I fucking love that, Lem.
That's it, though. That's what it. This is, you know. Yes. That's one of the four-line poems. You know, I am a bull in the china shop. And with all my strength and will, as a storm smashed the teacups, I stood still.
Yes.
The witness.
Yes.
And the person who's taking the blame.
That's life-changing, I think. I think we're all trying to do that in our own way.
Yeah.
If you can step back and see the chaos around you or the voice in your head or whatever, it's life-changing. And it's probably a daily discipline. I don't think it's one you just nail and you're like, oh, I do that now the time.
Yeah.
It's every day. It's every day. Do you know what was... I mean, there's so many moments in the book where I learned a ton and I was taken aback at, you know, how awful the care system was. And what I am ignorant to today,
yep,
is what the care system is like now. Mm. Is it better? Because, you know, certainly the last home you were in, I was horrified to read some of the stuff going on there. I probably shouldn't have been as horrified. I probably should have known a lot more about it, but it was extremely informative. How much better is the care system today?
There's just been a care review happened by a man called Josh McAllister. It took 1 year to do. It's a brilliant review. And the care system is left wanting at the moment. 80% of kids in care are fostered now. About 20% are in children's homes. Frankly, it's a mess right now. So there's a lot of kids who are paying for it being a mess now.
Mm.
Now, I've got to say, there's going to be some people in fostering who are doing really well, and that's as you would expect. That's how it should be. But there is a high percentage who are having a horrific time in care, and that's not good. So I'm not taking away from the ones who are... the care system's working for them. But it is worth knowing that there's a lot wrong with the care system at the moment. And there's a lot of people fighting for the changes that are needed in the system. So I don't want to be a doomsayer, but it is better than it's ever been. But that doesn't mean anything to a kid.
No.
A kid will never go, well, it was bad in the 60s.
Yeah, I'm all right.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because it was bad in the 60s, it's better now.
Yeah.
There is no relative experience like that for
people. No.
Just as your children won't go, well, if I was a child in the 1960s, I couldn't do X, Y, and Z, but I can now, you know. So, but I think that the internet is changing everything. There are a lot of witness. It's playing witness for a lot of young people. The book I brought for you is, for you, actually, is by a woman called Camilla Batmangelo.
I know. I've met her.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
And it's called Kids, and it's what she wrote. It's about her, it's her manifesto, really.
Yeah, I'd love to read that.
It's for you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
This is a subject that I desperately want to learn about and need to learn about. And you know, also looking at care leavers, because I know that's something you're deeply passionate about and trying to help with. What can be done to help care leavers to integrate and have a good life?
There's more happening for care leavers now than there's ever been. A care leaver is a person who's been in care of the state and then leaves at 18 to become an adult. So, the care leavers need jobs and they need help as well, a lot of times therapeutic help, and they need to feel that they have worth. And this comes through employment, and it comes through education, and it comes through housing, and it comes through health. So a lot of the different departments of the corporate parent, as it's known in society.
How do you feel about that term?
No, it's a term that is quite cold, corporate parent, but its meaning is good. It means that a child who leaves the children's homes and becomes an adult needs care of all of the different departments, health, housing, work, etc., etc. And I think the NHS and companies are starting to get behind employing young people who've left the care system. And also there's a lot of access to education for care leavers as well. Education's a good way of sort of transcending class, you know, going from one class to another. Yeah, so there's a lot of good work going on at the moment. Yeah.
What if there are people listening now, I'm certainly one of them, who thinks, well, I'd like to help do something. What can I do? I don't want to sit here just helplessly listening to, you know, that improvements need to be made or care leavers need a bit of support.
Great question. If you're in a workplace, there's a company called Care Leaver Covenant who connect care leavers to big business, but also small business. So if you have a company and you're looking for interns, then I would contact the Care Leaver Covenant.
Never heard of it. How brilliant.
Yeah. It was started by the Education Department, who contacted a guy called Matthew, who set up the Care Leaver Covenant about 5 years ago. It's just grown massively. And it's about the organisation understanding that this person may need a little bit more care and attention. Simple as that. But actually, the people who are least served in society are the ones who work hardest and who, when they do work, work hardest and who will be the ones to come back years later and say thank you, because what you did for me was pivotal. Mm. You know? So if you have a company out there, contact the Care Leaver Covenant and see if there are, you know, young people in care who could work for you or with you as interns, etc.
That's a beautiful initiative.
Yeah, it's great to hear you say this, because I know the man who started it. I know how it started. I know the effect it's having. And so, it's great to hear you. Yeah. And you can Google Care Leaver Covenant, you'll find the details. That's just one initiative. There are many others. It's a brilliant organisation in Hackney called Big House Theatre that works with care leavers in theatre, and they're getting 5-star reviews with every show. In all of the newspapers. They're doing incredibly well, and they work with disaffected. We have to watch our language, don't we? You know, challenging
semantics.
Yeah, challenging. You know, yeah. Child was a very challenging children. Yeah. Challenging. All children are challenging.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's the nature of childhood.
Do you know what? That's one of the things that I think upset me most about reading your official paperwork was how the care system talked about you, that you were either problematic or struggling mentally or having challenging behaviour. But what do you expect? You know, a child like yourself, it's almost like reading about a caged animal, that there are all these rules and this system in place that you're just having to live through. No shit you're going to be experiencing different mental challenges and problems and acting out. What else are they expecting? I was almost sort of screaming at the book, like, what?
That's why I wrote the book, because I wanted you to witness what I was going through.
Yeah.
That's like, my book has done its job there, because I wanted people to see what was happening to me when I was in there over 18 years. And the only way to do it was to actually show the files. Because would you believe that, you know? Would you believe that all those different people were saying those things about that boy over that amount of time?
It's just unreal. You know,
yes, which is why I did it. What came to mind then was, I was going to say, oh, well, I was a naughty kid at times, I stole biscuits from the tin at my foster parents without saying please and thank you. Now, they didn't know, and I started smoking when I was 12 as well. I was the first adolescent, and they thought that there was something really bad inside me. They didn't have the experience of...
Nope, you were the oldest in the family.
I was the oldest in the family. So when they looked at me and they were like, what the hell is going on? You know, a lot of parents have done that with their children. They're like, who are you? When they go through their teenage years. And you have to know that I had to work that out myself. So that as I was going a teenager, I didn't work that out. I worked that out in my 20s and 30s when I look back at my child, I was like, oh God, I was the oldest child, the adolescents. Of course they were. And then I worked out, oh, my foster mum was a twin, because I used to go and visit my foster mum's twin. And then I realized the psychology of my foster mum, because the twin was in an asylum. So that means that my foster mum quite possibly felt guilt at being the survivor of the twin that I used to visit, my auntie, who used to sit rocking in a chair with her, and my foster mum would say, come and say hello to your auntie. I loved her, you know, and I felt like she recognised me, etc. And so a big smile from me, you know. And then I realised, so my foster mum had... And then I realised my foster mum used to talk about my auntie and say that my auntie had a picture up on my grandma's wall, and that my... Why is her not picture on my grandma's wall? And then I was like, my grandma couldn't acknowledge my foster mum, her daughter, because her foster mum reminded her of her other daughter in the asylum.
Wow.
And my foster mum felt great guilt about that. So she fosters babies.
Mm.
That's me, that my adolescence challenged her validity to her own mother and her sister. And then I thought, my foster mum has a birthday. Her twin sister has exactly the same birthday. So when my foster mum has a birthday, she feels like that was the day she took from her own sister. So I got to understand my family, understand their motivations, understand her anger. And then it all starts to fall into place. And then I have, because this is public, I have people coming out of the woodwork to tell me stories. Woman finds me at an event and tells me, your mum used to have dark days. And we come round to the house, and if she had dark days, all the windows were closed and the curtains were closed, and we had to not be in the house. And I was like, of course my mum suffered depression. And of course it was when she had babies.
Yeah.
What would a baby remind her of having her own child? Postnatal depression is what she had. And nobody was there for her. And here's me, this child, just giving her love because she's my mum. And she found love incredibly difficult to receive. So your child will find your weakest spot.
Isn't it a mad thing when you start to see the adults who are around you as a kid, as humans?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you, as a kid, obviously, you just go, adult, they know what they're doing. And then you go, oh, maybe, like, whether it's parents,
absolutely,
teachers,
absolutely,
other relatives, you know, caregivers, whoever it is, that you go, oh, they're humans with a story. But I think it's also really, it's an incredible thing that you've got to that place of understanding their psychology and their backstory. Because, you know, you went through some very tricky shit. But also, I guess it alleviates for you a resentment that could very well be there.
I had resentment all my life towards her. And I, by the way, I've watched people go through that process of understanding their parents more as well. You know, I'm like, yeah. And I mean, family is the place where you can, thankfully, be utterly selfish. What about me?
Yeah.
You didn't do it for me. Now, it doesn't make sense that everything is about you, but actually family is a place where you can go, no, it is though.
Mm.
And therefore you can feel betrayed because it's not actually all about you. And that's one of the beautiful things about getting older and seeing the people in your family as people. It's therapy, that stopping drinking as well, that actually stopped me resenting the family. I think forgiveness was the moment where my resentment sort of like really fell away. When I forgave, I was like, when I forgave my foster mum, she said, oh, She said, I had a terrible time with my own mother. And I said to her, do you think I didn't know that? Mm. Do you think I've not spent in that wilderness that you gave me, like all my life thinking about, if it isn't me, what is it? Because for the first part of my life, I thought it had to be me. Then she said, oh, but you were a naughty kid. Mm-hmm. And I think I probably was, but I was naughty in the most, in a quite a charming way. I know the kid that I was. It's not who I am now, but I know that kid. What is it? Bitterness rots the vessel that carries it.
Yeah.
You know, it's in the book, but it's not actually my thing. That I don't know whose it is, but it's not mine. But and I remember realizing that as well. The book stops with me. The book stops with me, man. It's me that's got to, you know, carry this. And also that your story doesn't alleviate, he said, crossing his arms. His story doesn't. That's really interesting. I'm looking forward to watching this back. Because I know, because you actually do things as well.
In fact,
I'm not going to say it out loud because I was quite, oh, that's really interesting. Because you get a real, there's a whole different conversation.
I'm paranoid.
There's a whole different conversation going, because this is locked down, the shot. Mm. There's a whole conversation that you have and that I have, by the way.
Yeah, physical that all people,
absolutely.
Translation.
And actually, I think that a person, you should get on somebody who reads body language because you're in your happy
terrifying
place. And so you are relaxed.
I am, and I'm in this chat, Lem.
Yes,
I'm
yes,
like,
no,
I don't even know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah,
I'm in it.
And that's the way
I'm living and breathing it.
So your movements are actually, and I did watch one, I was like, that's really interesting. Not that I could interpret them.
Oh, for you.
But yeah.
Do you know what I'd love to ask you? And I wonder what you would relate this to. But
Fern Caton.
Your whole story.
So say names differently. Caton. My name's Fern Caton.
Well, you could be Lem or Lemen.
Well, in Ethiopia,
that's
it's
the one.
Innocent
I love
Lemon.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
What does belonging mean to you? Having spoken about this wilderness, having this understanding of your roots in Ethiopia, but your life growing up in the UK, what does it mean to you? What does it feel like?
Belonging is when all of your story becomes invisible to the power of the exact moment that you're in. This is a conversation between us. Mm. I'm trying to not give answers that I've given before, trying to be in the present as much as I can so I can give the answers, trying to watch for myself slipping into storyteller mode, which is trying to cast a spell, trying not to be this. I'll give you an example. Snake Charmer. He's playing a snake charm. This will look good on a visual podcast, but not on Spotify. But I'm pretending that I'm playing an oboe or something.
Yeah.
And the snake comes out to the rhythm of the oboe, right? That's what it basically is feeling. Snake comes out. Right. Good network there, by the way.
I was the snake.
And then the snake comes up. But what you have to watch for, and a lot of performers have to watch for this, not yourself, but performers on stage and poets and what have you, is that there comes a point that you can be hypnotized by the snake that you think you're hypnotizing.
Mm.
Okay? So you're da-da-da-da-da, and the snake's coming, but it's hypnotizing you, and you're not engaged. It's your trick. It's what you do. Okay? And I see this in performers and people. I'm like, you're snake charming. You're not present. Everybody's wowing the snake coming up and the music you're playing, but you're not there.
Mm.
You know, so I think my sense of belonging, if I can get to a sense of belonging, is to be in the present and no tricks.
What a very astute and beautiful answer. I love that. I wasn't expecting that either. I could quite literally talk to you for the next 12 months and I'd still have questions and things that I want to ask you, but I have thoroughly enjoyed spending time with you, Lem, and just thank you for your beautiful writing that brings me so much joy and for inspiring me to write better and to actually get back into writing poetry for fun, because I love writing poetry.
Yes, that's the way to do it,
yes,
man. Write as, what did they say, dance as if nobody's watching, but write as if nobody's reading.
Yes.
All right, write as if nobody's flipping reading, man.
Beautiful, beautiful. Lem, thank you so much.
Thank you, Fern Cotton. I'm enjoying your podcast. I'm proud to have been here on it and for you to have asked me on it. And thank you for what you said about my book when you put it out, which was very wonderful on Insta.
I know, do you know what? Behind the scenes, for listeners, a lot of the time with guests, they're, let's just talk frankly about this, they're on a press run and they're like, do you want to speak to blah, blah? Yes, please. I was like, we need to get Lem on the podcast. How do we reach him? I'm going to do some Instagram stuff. We need to get his attention. I've been desperate to get you on. So that was on this occasion, we were like begging for you to come on and you said yes. We're very glad.
Thank you, because I'd stopped like doing stuff because I feel like a bit of a husk, you know, like you know, like telling your story, I don't want to ever feel like that, and I'm not, I'm a poet by trade, so you know we don't have as much as press runs as we bite off the arms of anybody who actually wants to write about us, but in this case, because I'd seen what you're about and what Happy Places and everything, I thought, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. I want to give you this as well. I think this more so.
Go on, what's this?
She's got 500,000 followers on Instagram. She's young, she's in her mid to late 20s, and she's a poet, and she's awesome. And this is her first book, and this is not even a selling book. This is, and she is, it's out on the 22nd of February. This is about you being introduced to a poet that I think you're going to absolutely freaking, absolutely, she's on fire from the first poem.
Oh, I can't wait.
It's called Poems.
Len Penny. And you, the first poem is called Honey.
From the first poem.
That's just my daughter's name.
Well, there's, I love things like that.
Me too.
I love things like that. She's absolutely fierce and on fire. Yeah.
Oh, Lem, thank you so much. Lem! Oh my gosh, that was just the biggest joy to spend time with you. I'm obsessed that he called me out on my little body language tics as well, which I'm still intrigued about. What does it say about me and my inner workings? Oh, I dread to think. It was the way that I touched my hair that he picked up on. You can always watch the podcast on the Happy Place YouTube channel as well if you want. You can see the whole thing. You can see the snake charming mime that he did, the sort of invisible instrument. It was a particular highlight of mine. So that book that Lem really kindly gave me at the end of the podcast was called Poems by a poet called Len Penny. You can get a copy of that alongside Lem's brilliant book, Let the Light Pour In. And just because I'd like to say book a few more times, I'll let you know that I'd love it if you were part of the Happy Place Book Club. We're on Instagram at Happy Place Book Club. And we chat about books, what we're reading at the moment, and we just get really nerdy about it. I'd love you to join us. Okay, until next time, a huge thank you again to Lem, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Happy Place Studios, and to you. I love you.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.